Dr. Friedhoff, you've been called the father of Alzheimer's treatment, given your role in the creation of the drug Aricept. How has the Alzheimer's disease treatment landscape evolved since Aricept first came on the market almost 20 years ago? And what's the landscape of treatments today?
There's been really a sea change in the Alzheimer's treatment world since those days. Now, back then, I discovered the molecule that would become Aricept after it had discovered the molecule. I found the molecule after it had been in a few healthy volunteer studies in Japan and then discontinued from development. And the reason it was discontinued from development, in spite of the fact that I thought it had a lot of potential, is that the landscape was quite different in those days. Even the term Alzheimer's disease was really not widely known, certainly to the public and even in the medical community. Dementia occurring in older people, you know, by and large, not by the super experts, but by and large by most people, was just considered something that happened as people got older. It happened, you know, more quickly to some people than other people. There wasn't really much that you could do about it, and it was kind of considered a normal part of what life. You know, this is just what happened when you got old. So there was a lot of nihilism and pessimism about the ability to ever be able to treat this illness, which is why it was initially, you know, why this molecule was originally dropped from development. It was just not a belief among people that there was really much that you could do, even though there was a little bit of evidence that this drug did help people, drugs of this class did help people with dementia and in particular with Alzheimer's disease. Of course, things are much different now. We have five products that were approved years ago for Alzheimer's disease treatment by the FDA. And so at least now people believe that it is possible to develop treatments for Alzheimer's disease, and that is a qualitative difference from the days back in the 90s when I was involved with getting Aricept off the ground.
Can you tell me about that experience that led to the development of Aricept?
It had been in a few healthy volunteer studies, so we knew a little bit about it. Seemed to be reasonably well tolerated, and there was some evidence from other molecules that targeted the same function in the body that this kind of drug might be efficacious. And so that's what originally motivated me and ultimately the company I was working for to fund some initial trials to see whether the drug would work. We actually started with just a very small office and one or two people. So I had to hire a team, turned out to be a team of very talented people. We did an initial small trial, a study in humans, comparing the molecule that would become Aricept to placebo, and showed that it did improve cognition, and there was some evidence that it improved the function of the patients as well. And so once we had that information, then there was a much clearer rationale for pushing the development ahead at an accelerated pace, which is what we did.
You gave people hope, I think, as much as anything else.
Yeah, that's right. I think we were certainly part of changing the way people thought about this illness. And I never really thought about it in that way, but maybe that's the most important thing that we did. It was to be part of giving people hope that there are things that can be done to help patients with Alzheimer's disease.
And you have a personal connection to Alzheimer's, if you don't mind talking about it, through your mom's living with the disease. How did your personal caregiving affect or influence your work?
Well, actually, I trained as an internist when I was a young man. I went to medical school and did medical training thereafter. And, you know, internists mostly treat elderly patients. And so I had a lot of exposure to patients with dementia, which is one of the reasons why I was motivated to try and develop the molecule that became Aricept. I already had from that experience, for whatever reason, you know, probably an unusual empathy with people who had this condition. I can't tell you exactly why, but that's just the way I was at the time. Now, of course, when it touches your own family, you sort of experience it in a different way. I can only tell you the way I tried to think about it during the time that my mother had this diagnosis. And there are just a couple of things that, you know, that I tried to keep in mind. Number one, this was the most important. Even as the disease progressed, if I was patient and the other members of my family were patient, you know, we could still see my mother. She was still in there somewhere. And, you know, if you were patient and observant, you could see that. So we never really felt like we had completely lost her until she passed away. Number two, although it's an illness with a grim prognosis, not everyone progresses at the same rate, and patients have good days and bad days. And so I think, you know, like a lot of things, people struggle with in life, it's just important to try and live, you know, day by day and month by month, hope for the best and be prepared for the worst. And finally, you know, because I'm involved in that community, this is important to me, and I think other people who are in that kind of position should remember, you know, you're really not alone. This is not an uncommon illness. Many other people struggle with it. There are lots of support groups around. And although many caregivers may not come into contact with us on a regular basis, you know, there are many, many people working to defeat this disease, and we are making progress against it.
The fact that you're not alone is such a great feeling for a family caregiver.
Yeah, I know that from my professional experience and my personal experience as well. There's now more than ever support groups and, as I said, people working to help in many ways in the care and development of new treatments and so on. And I agree with you. That was very important to me personally.
One thing we also see at the event and through the magazine, through talking to caregivers over the last 20 years, is that so many times they come to the value proposition of clinical trials with negative preconceived notions. I always call it malinformed as opposed to just misinformed, because what they know isn't just wrong, but also worse than what's real. And I think the one big challenge for all of us trying to advocate clinical trials for family caregivers is to overcome this malinformation. What would you say to a family caregiver who is possibly looking at a clinical trial but may be coming at it with, you know, incorrect information up front?
Yeah, so the first thing to remember is that most companies have very strict standards about clinical trials. Certainly ours does, and most almost all do. So when a clinical trial is conducted, it's always on the belief of the people who are implementing it that it represents a potential benefit for patients at an acceptable risk. Now, all therapies have some risk associated with them. That's the first thing I would say, is that, you know, companies are thoughtful about that. In addition, every clinical trial conducted in the United States has to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration, at least for a new drug. And they also evaluate the potential risks and benefits for the patient. And if they feel that the benefits don't outweigh the risks, then they can prevent a company from conducting a clinical trial. And third, there's an independent board called an Institutional Review Board that also reviews all clinical trials of new drugs in the United States to make sure, again, that the risk-benefit ratio is reasonable for the patients who are intended to be enrolled. So there are a lot of protections that are available, and there's also the institutional protections. One of the things that all of these organizations approve is the consent form that patients have to sign, or their caregivers or both, have to sign before they're allowed to participate in a clinical trial. And that consent form, again, outlines in terms that should be understandable to, you know, non-experts what the potential risks and benefits are to patients. And so patients and their caregivers should read that consent form carefully and make sure that although the risks and benefits may be judged acceptable for the average patient, that they seem to be acceptable for this particular patient, because every person is different, of course. And to the extent that there are any questions about that, they should ask the people who are conducting the trial, including the physician who's in charge of it. There's always a physician in charge. And ultimately, they can even take the consent form to their own personal physician and ask his or her opinion about whether this kind of clinical trial is the best one for this, you know, for this particular patient. It's very important to have people participate in clinical trials because, unfortunately, for most classes of drugs that we're now trying to develop to treat Alzheimer's disease, there aren't any animal tests. There's no animal testing we can do that will predict whether the drug will be effective in people. The animal studies only give us a little bit of a hint. And so really the only way we can tell whether a drug is likely to help patients is by actually giving it to them. And that's what we do in clinical trial.
Your current work is with a new compound in clinical trial for Alzheimer's. It's a add-on therapy for Aricept. Can you talk more about it?
Yes. Unfortunately, over the last 10 to 12 years, although there have been many compounds studied, no new drugs have been approved for Alzheimer's disease. And that is, primarily for the reason that I said a minute ago. The justification for doing these trials was based mostly on animal data, and, you know, we do the best we can from animal data, but those kinds of experiments don't really tell us much about what will happen in people. RVT-101, which is the product that we're developing, is the first drug I've seen in many years where there's actual evidence from people that's quite strong suggesting that it improves cognition and function, that is thinking and the ability to perform normal activities of daily living in patients with Alzheimer's disease. This is the result. The results I'm talking about come from what's called a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, which is the gold standard way of evaluating the efficacy and safety of a new drug. And so that's really what motivated me to return to clinical development of this drug for Alzheimer's disease, because I personally think it is probably the product with the best chance of getting approved by regulators.
Is that what drew you to want to work on this trial?
Yes, that's exactly what it was. Of course, I've followed the field for the last 10 years, but I've mostly not been involved because I viewed most of the products as being long shots. There's always a chance, but this is the first one that I think has a very good chance, at least. That's my judgment of it, and it's based on science, not just on my own opinion. The results from a very well conducted, controlled clinical trial, which is what, for example, FDA requires that kind of evidence, and they're the most demanding regulatory authority in the world. The other thing I'd like to mention is that although, as a scientist, I like to think of science as being a very methodical process where we have a definite pathway that's very mechanical that leads us from understanding a disease to its cure. The reality is that many times great scientific discoveries come kind of out of the blue and unexpectedly. And so I think it's important for people, again, particularly caregivers, to maintain hope that things, you know, may come quite unexpectedly, even after a long period of time when there haven't been many successes in clinical trials. The successful trial of RVT-101 is one example of that. That, you know, it was a very little known therapeutic area and very little known approach to trying to treat Alzheimer's disease. But lo and behold, when the study was over, there was very strong evidence that the drug worked.
Can you tell me a bit about the scientist dog? Because I love Henry, and I know that my dog thinks about me the same way that Henry expressed in the book. And mine's only a puppy, so I have many years of the chagrin that he looks at me when he sees me trying to think my stupid human thoughts.
It's interesting that you asked that question. I certainly didn't expect it. What I tried to explain in that little book is a more general attempt to explain what I said earlier, which is, although we tend to think of science as being a linear enterprise, where people with white coats who are super intelligent, slowly and methodically chip away at ignorance and build a model of a disease and then in a very methodical way figure out how to treat it and cure it. The reality is actually quite different. As a practicing scientist, I can tell you that a lot of what we do is like that, but a lot of what we do is just pay attention to things that we may not completely understand. So when people, for example, with RVT-101, we think we understand how our drug works. We know what receptor it binds to. We know some of the consequences of that. But the most important thing to me is that someone had the courage to do a clinical trial and invest a lot of time and money to show that it actually helps patients. And so once I saw that, I was much less concerned about the details. And I think that's a little bit the way dogs think. You know, they don't think much about why things are happening. They just try and follow the path of least resistance to where they need to get to. And in science, sometimes it's important to be very methodical, but other times it's important to act. When you find a drug that you think can help millions of people, that's not being pursued in development, which is, I think, has happened once with Aricept, and I think has now happened again. You know, you have a moral imperative to move it along as best you can, or to contribute to that, independent of anything scientific. This is now more dog-like thinking, right? You can help a lot of people, and if you have the ability to do that, you should just do it without thinking too much about why it will help a lot of people. It's nice to know that, but most patients don't care why a drug works. They just care that it does and that it helps. If you look at the lower productivity that we've seen in clinical trials over the years, I think some of it is due to that very linear mechanical thinking rather than just recognizing, hey, this drug works. Let's do what we need to get it to patients right away.
Need to be a bit dogmatic.
Dogmatic, exactly.
Can you share with me the one most important piece of advice that you'd like to share with family caregivers, with loved ones living with Alzheimer's?
Remember that you're not alone. Remember that every patient is different, and no one can predict the future with absolute certainty. And in particular, remember that not only are the more visible support groups around, like yours and others, the Alzheimer's Association and so on, but there's an army of very dedicated people who are laboring away in obscurity to some degree, looking for new treatments for this terrible illness. And we are highly motivated and very diligent and hardworking people. And we're here working all the time, even though you may not see us most of the time. And eventually, that kind of effort and diligence pays off sooner or later, one way or another. And I think we'll, you know, my personal feeling is that we are entering a time when there's more hope for new treatments than I've seen in quite some time, which is why I wanted to be a part of it.